Hello and welcome to the Risk Map Podcast, part of the global conversation on geopolitics and security, produced by Control Risks, the leading international risk consultancy. I'm Charles Hecker, senior partner in London. As we do every 2 weeks, the Risk Map Podcast will travel around the world to discuss some of the most pressing, the most relevant, and the most interesting issues in risk. This time, as every time, there has been no shortage of material to discuss.
In fact, we were about to release this podcast when we were overtaken by events. London on the 3rd of June suffered a terrorist attack, the third in the UK in as many months. And on Monday, the 5th of June, Egypt and Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and the UAE severed relations with GCC partner Qatar, just as we were planning a podcast piece to look at US President Donald Trump's trip to Riyadh. We have comments on the situation in the GCC all across our social media profile and up on our website, controlrisks.com.
But today we want to talk about London. And then we want to talk about how best practice in event security is going to have to evolve in the wake of Manchester. We'll end on Brazil by talking with Simon Whistler, who heads our analysis for Latin America. We'll talk about what he calls Brazil's impossible choice. But first, London.
We have relied far too often in the past on the expertise of senior Europe analyst David Lee to explain the unexplainable for us. Dave and I are sitting here in our offices on the South Bank of the Thames with a view of London Bridge. Dave, let's just start off simply with what happened this past weekend.
So, at about 10 o'clock on Saturday night, a hired-by-the-hour van came from the north side of London Bridge across to the south side, crossed over the central reservation at some point on the way onto the pavement or sidewalk, struck a few pedestrians on its way down, eventually crashed into street furniture at the foot of the bridge just by a pub that we can't quite see from where we're sitting now. The driver got out of his door, two men got out of the rear of the van, ran into the adjacent Borough Market area, which is an area of bars, restaurants, market stalls, very busy at 10 o'clock on a Saturday night, started stabbing passers-by, in all between the victims on the bridge and the people stabbed. There are seven fatalities and approximately 50 people injured. Police arrived within a few minutes of the first call and shot all three perpetrators at two separate locations within the Borough Market area within 8 minutes of the first being called.
Dave, let's focus on a couple of things as we discuss what this event does and doesn't mean. First of all, the claim by IS. How much stock do you put in that?
IS claims have become increasingly unreliable over the last year or so, and it's actually quite notable that a few months ago when IS made a claim about the Westminster attacker, it was immediately treated as highly credible, only then to be disproved pretty early on in the investigation. This time it hasn't been a major feature of the media narrative in the immediate aftermath of the attack at all. So while it's possible that these people were inspired by IS, it doesn't look as if they were directly ordered around by them.
Dave, second, this is the third attack in the UK in the past 3 months, the second one in London. The combination of intelligence, law enforcement, public vigilance is working because this could be happening a lot more often. But once again, we have a perpetrator or group of perpetrators who appear to have been known to the authorities before this attack happened. Impact or your thoughts on public safety and living and working here in the center of London?
Yeah, I think it is notable that certainly at least one of the people here appears, in the absence of official confirmation of his identity, but appears to be someone who's known to both the security services and to a documentary maker who filmed a number of Islamist extremists who were at liberty in Britain a couple of years ago. We don't know that for certain yet, but it's looking increasingly likely. Very reliable sources reporting it. The UK's counter-terrorism activity has been pretty strong in the last few years, and it's been a mix of surveillance intelligence, very importantly community intelligence. Imams and other mosque officials have been an important source of intelligence for identifying people who've become radicalized, and particularly those who've become radicalized to the point of violence. Now, there are reports that both the Manchester attacker and at least one of the attackers from the London Bridge attack appear to have been identified by people from their own mosques, and that doesn't appear to have followed through. So obviously there are concerns about the effectiveness of that model going forward, but it is a major advance that the UK has made relative to other European countries, gaining community confidence in that kind of thing. Before the recent attacks, there's been a relatively long period of quiet from Islamist extremists in the UK in the form of actually attacking. Obviously, many have gone to Syria and many have become radicalised and tried to radicalise other people as well. But I think it's important to note that at the moment, this counts as a spike rather than a plateau. And I think that's the security interpretation we'd put on that going forward.
Well, picking up exactly on that point, Dave, listeners to the Risk Map podcast should, or at least I hope, should know that control risks rate the security of cities, regions, and countries around the world. What's your feeling about the rating for the UK or for London? Will it remain at low as it currently is? Do you see any upward pressure on that in the immediate future, or are we staying put?
There's upper pressure on any country rating or city rating after any terrorist attack. That's only normal. Upper pressure doesn't have to translate into an upwards move, however, particularly when you're working with a 5-point scale. And for the moment, we're keeping London and the UK at low terrorism on the basis that occasional attacks are part of the low definition. It's well documented that attacks can come in spikes, and that's what's happened here. There can be copycats, there can be people who would accelerate planning to make sure that they don't get swept up in a crackdown. We remember what happened here in 2005. So for now, we think that the low rating remains appropriate for the UK.
Thanks, Dave. I know you're going to be coming back to the Risk Map podcast, hopefully not to talk about terrorist incidents, but we've got the UK elections coming up on the 8th of June. They'll be over in time for the next Risk Map podcast. And then 11 days after the 8th, we have the kickoff of Brexit negotiations.
Absolutely.
So, Dave, it's not goodbye. It's talk to you soon, and thank you very much.
Indeed. See
you. On May 22nd, Manchester was the scene of an even more gruesome terrorist attack. We don't want to get into too many details about what happened on the ground or comment on topics that are currently under investigation. But we did talk to Bill Udell.
Bill is a senior partner in our Americas business and looks after the crisis and security management consultancy across North and South America and has a background as a former government counterterrorism expert. Bill, tell us a little bit, if you can, about what the event in Manchester represents and how it tells us about the changing or evolving terrorist threat.
Well, Chuck, first, thanks very much for having me. It's a really important question, and there are sort of two answers to it. Sort of in one way, what happened in Manchester is a continuation of trends we've seen in recent attacks. In another way, it is a bit of a departure and a bit of an adaptation. So first of all, I would say on the continuation side, we have an attacker that is acting in his local area, clearly consuming propaganda from the Islamic State and other organizations, and acting using a device, while a little bit more sophisticated, that was available locally, most likely. Again, not to prejudge the investigation that's ongoing. So that aspect of sort of local action and a combination of inspiration and, you know, potentially some direction, that is a sort of an aspect that is a continuation of what we've seen certainly in more recent homegrown attacks. Where it's a bit of a departure is in two areas, I would say. One is the use of explosives, so getting away from what we've seen recently around sort of vehicle ramming and the Islamic State-inspired attacks using anything that you can pick up, sort of very unsophisticated attacks, vehicles, firearms, hatchets, things like that, even though that explosive itself may be relatively unsophisticated. And then the second area is around the adapting to security implementation in the targeting of the attack itself. So attacking outside of the perimeter, outside of the venue itself, not trying to get through security. Again, something that we've seen lately in terms of threat actors learning, sharing lessons learned from previous attacks, and then conducting an attack outside of where they would be under scrutiny by security.
Bill, how is this going to impact the way event organizers think about security? I mean, this has been a slight change, a slight modification in tactics, and the site is bigger than any of the previous sites that we've seen attacked most recently.
Right.
What should event organizers be thinking about? What will they be thinking about for the future?
Right. So this is a really important question and something that venue owners, event organizers, sponsors, anyone that has kind of that shared duty of care for major events is really grappling with now, and honestly grappled with before the Manchester attack. But the Manchester attack is, for the reasons that you stated, is sort of an escalation in their thinking on this. The key issue there is, what are the threats and risks that are reasonably foreseeable? And the sophistication of this attack, the mass scale of it, the nature of the people that were targeted, the profile of the event itself, and the fact that it occurred outside of the perimeter, and that it occurred in a local area where the threat actor lived, and that it wasn't necessarily a tier one sort of national level event. These are all sort of combined to really change what that calculus is for event organizers. So there's about five things that they're grappling with, I think. One is around their threat assessments and ongoing threat monitoring. So how do they tackle understanding what is reasonably foreseeable for them, and how do they ingest intelligence feeds to help operationalize that thinking? The second is around the organization, so the organization of security for events. And one of the things that event organizers complain about quite a lot is the fact that there are many different cooks in the kitchen when it comes to events. So you have the venue owner, you have the organizers, you have the sponsors, you have the local police department, you have federal law enforcement potentially, and everybody has their own security plan. So rationalizing that and for event organizers and sponsors, and particularly figuring out where their duty of care lies and how much ownership they need to take. And then you have obviously the hard security bits. So the guards, gates, and guns, the mag and bag, the perimeter, where do you put that now in light of the Manchester attack? Realizing that no matter where you put that, there are still going to be groups of people queuing outside of that perimeter, wherever you put that perimeter, and that is potentially where people can be targeted now. Then recognizing that, there is a need for a softer approach to security to sort of round out that hard security, if you will. And that's really around behavioral surveillance, having people in the crowd that are looking for signs of behavior that might indicate a move to a mobilization phase by a potential threat actor, and also measures to encourage bystanders to report, so the see something, say something aspect. And then finally, looking at crisis management and incident management plans, and looking at the reality that no matter what you put in place to mitigate the likelihood of the event, you're still not absolved from measures to mitigate the impact. So making sure that they can respond effectively to mitigate that impact should it occur.
Bill, those are fantastic insights. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chuck.
If you want more information on Bill Udell's thinking on event security, please visit our website, controlrisks.com, where Bill and his team have produced a short briefing. Finally, the long-running political telenovela that is the Brazilian presidency seems to grow only more scandalous with time. The latest twist involves current President Michel Temer, who's facing fresh calls to vacate the Palacio de Alvarado after being tape-recorded discussing bribes with a Brazilian businessman. Simon Whistler, who looks after political risk analysis for Latin America, says that Brazil now faces an impossible choice.
Simon, do you want to explain to us a little bit about why you're calling Brazil's current situation an impossible choice?
Yes, so it's an impossible choice because you've got a president in President Michel Temer who's facing very severe corruption allegations against him. And you're looking at kind of what could happen next if Temer was to be forced from office or was to resign over these allegations. And under the current constitution, you would then have the president of the lower house in Congress becoming president for an interim period, and then Congress itself electing a new president. And a lot of people think that would be the best option out of this. Brazil needs the economic reforms that Temer has been pushing, and they think the best way to keep that going is by having Congress elect a technocratic type president. The finance minister, Henrique Meirelles, has been spoken as one of those who could push through those reforms to maintain market confidence in Brazil. It's just come out of a 2-year recession. The latest GDP figures came out over the past few days, the country coming out of recession. The fear is if that Temer goes and he's not followed by a leader who follows in his reforming footsteps and putting the country on a steadier financial and economic footing, then that those gains are going to be lost and Brazil's going to be heading back into economic crisis. The problem with this is that essentially Congress is deeply, deeply discredited. You've got 60% or so of its members who are under some sort of corruption investigation at the moment. You have, I think, at least the next two in line for the presidency, including the man who would take over from Temer directly if he were to be forced from office or to resign. So in terms of the legitimacy, potentially, that a new president or just for Congress to have to elect a new president, then I think there are very significant questions over that. Obviously, it would be in line with the constitution, but almost from a kind of a moral point of view, and you've got a lot of public outrage, a lot of social unrest against the current political class. I think it would be a very sort of difficult situation for them to present that this is something that is right for the country. And on the other hand, there are calls for direct elections. That would require a constitutional change. That would require Congress, which is probably against that, to make that constitutional change to allow for direct elections to happen ahead of schedule that are due for 2018. So they need that change for them to happen this year in 2017. Direct elections, you would think, would bring greater legitimacy to a new government, but also on the economic side of things, puts those reforms, those needed efforts to put Brazil back on a steady footing into question again. If you look at some of the leading contenders for if an election was held tomorrow, then top of the list you have former President Lula da Silva, himself facing corruption investigations, but he's the most popular politician in the country. You have a couple of very populist right-wing type candidates who again are also polling well, and have to be questions asked about, firstly, their political experience and also their respect for some of the institutional norms as well and their commitment to economic reforms. So elections, on the other hand, although perhaps they give a new government a stronger mandate, at least a direct public mandate to govern, there are significant questions about what that would mean for the economic future of the country, but also just the institutional strength and the fact that potentially even someone like Lula could get back into power when he himself is facing a lot of corruption investigations. So either way, the choice isn't perfect, and it really just shows kind of the deep, deep mess that has been uncovered in Brazil over the past 2 or 3 years of these very big corruption investigations.
Simon, why is there a school of thought out there, and do you subscribe to it, that says it's a good thing for Latin America on the whole that corruption has very much come to the forefront in Brazil? Is it right to think of this as the beginning of some sort of detox for the rest of Latin America?
I want to believe that. A lot of people want to believe that. A lot of people want to think that this is going to be a long process, but it's going to be the start of the strengthening of institutions, the strength of kind of real shift in public opinion against entrenched practices around corruption, and really kind of, yeah, a new beginning in terms of the way that corruption is perceived, the way that it's challenged, and the way that the perpetrators of corruption, whether at the bottom or the top of society, are prosecuted. That's the kind of the long-term rosy view of the situation. But there are also a lot of people in Latin America who don't think this has been very good, or the kind of the longer the investigations have gone on in Brazil, that it hasn't been very positive for the country and not necessarily so much for the region as well. Brazil, in terms of the overall economy, the corruption investigations, the corruption scandals have clearly had a very negative impact. And I think you're seeing the ripple effect of those across Latin America, where countries such as Mexico, Colombia, Peru, and some others, where there are suspicions of wide-scale corruption as well. And if potentially you were to look deeper below the surface of some of these suspicions, that has potentially very negative impacts for the economies as well.
Simon, if you had to make a choice, given this impossible choice, where do you see the immediate trajectory heading for Brazil? Is it elections or is it impeachment again? If you were a betting guy, what would you say?
I think the most likely is that they will go down the route of Congress electing a new president. This is, of course, if Temer is forced from office. Impeachment seems unlikely just because he maintains a significant groundswell of support in Congress. But the fact that you need a constitutional change to hold direct elections, plus that idea that you need that strong political leader, that kind of technocratic type person who can push through the economic reforms, that will probably push it down more the path of Congress electing a new president and hopefully taking the Brazil down that, at least that sort of strong economy. And then you have the elections next year to really get the popular mandate for a new government.
Great. Simon Whistler in Washington, D.C., thank you very much.
Thank you.
As if that weren't enough, here are a few other things we're keeping an eye on over the next 2 weeks. On the 11th and 18th of June, France will hold the two rounds of its parliamentary elections. After Emmanuel Macron's victory in the presidential election in early May, the latest polling suggests that his En Marche movement is likely to cause an even bigger upset by coming from nowhere to sweep traditional parties from their seats. On Saturday, the 17th of June, Russia kicks off the FIFA Confederations Cup. This international football tournament is liable to cause brief operational disruption in host cities including Moscow, St. Petersburg, Kazan, and Sochi. On Monday, the 26th of June, Mongolia will have its presidential election. Each of the country's three main political parties will put up candidates, and the campaign is likely to be lively and competitive. The current speaker of the Mongolian parliament, Myengobun Enkhbold, is likely to win. Oh, and one more thing. The RiskMap podcast wants your feedback. We have a new email address, podcast@controlrisks.com, and we want to hear what you think about our biweekly podcasts and anything that you'd like us to talk about. Drop us an email. We will respond to every message we get. Thanks very much for clicking and listening. Tune in again in another 2 weeks for another conversation about geopolitics, security, and risk around the world. In the meantime, this is Charles Hecker in London.